Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, July 23rd. The days are dwindling before the primary election. We take a look at the race for the number two job in the state with just a little more than 2 weeks before ballots are due. We look back at 20 years of service with Senator Karl Rhodes, described as one of the state's most liberal lawmakers. The longtime chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee won't be seeking re-election this year. And all about new, what do you know about coconuts, or what don't you know? We hear about a project in Hana, Maui to protect our native trees. And we play a new card game that teaches us about Hawaii seabird species.
Support for HPR comes from KTA Superstores, serving the Hawaii Island community since 1916, supporting Kupuna Wellness in its TV show Seniors Living in Paradise. KTASuperstores.com.
You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It is primary election season in Hawaii and things are heating up. HPR's political reporter Audrey McAvoy talks to us about two leading Democratic Party candidates for lieutenant governor. Audrey, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, and you've spent some time with them as they've been out campaigning.
That's right. That's right. So I spent some time with State Representative Della Alpilotti and Kauai Mayor Derek Kawakami.
Yeah. And who else is running in the race?
There's also a civil trial lawyer, John Choi.
Yes. And what's the lay of the land? Because I know Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke decided, just a short time ago that she was not running for re-election.
Exactly. Yes. In April, Sylvia Luke took a leave of absence and said she wouldn't run for re-election because the Attorney General's office had made her a target of an investigation into bribery. So she has denied the allegations, but she stepped down and is not running for re-election. So that's blown the race wide open. There's no incumbent.
Yeah. And so what do they say are the leading issues in this race?
The leading issues are the high cost of housing and high cost of living. All the candidates have agree on that.
And I understand that you were, out there trailing these candidates out in the field. What was the first stop for you?
The first stop was I was with Della Alpilotti. She had plans to go to a farmer's market, but her plans were thrown off because she had the campaign literature that she had with her said that she was running for Congress because she was originally planning to run for Congress. So she decided, well, she couldn't really go to the farmer's market with the congressional literature. So she changed her plans and instead she decided to go back to her condo. She took me to her condo where she was baking some cranberry bread that she hands out to voters.
So this is where I think the governor is somewhat on track, right? Pushing through, kind of hoping to work on speeding up permitting process. The legislature is also working on that. Representative Gregor Ilagon through the task force that he's done, the speed task force. We're really looking as a state, how can we help support the counties to make sure they can move more quickly through their procedures, through their permitting process. So respecting the guardrails, but also seeing where we can speed things up. So supply, building out supply is important. I think it's really exciting, the transit-oriented development and building neighborhoods that make sense around transit-oriented development. That's going to start to ratchet up really soon and now. And so that's another place where I think we can do a lot of work. We also need to double down on things like mortgage assistance programs. And we also have to not ignore the renter market. And so figuring out how we can make sure that there's priorities such as renter's assistance, mediation programs that keep people and landlords and tenants in a place where they can, where there's win-win for renters and landlords. We have to make sure there are programs in place for that.
And what about Kawakami? Does he have a different take on this?
So Kawakami highlighted to me some success that Kauai County has had building some affordable housing. There's a development called Lima Ola that when it's finished will have 550 units for sale and rent. He pointed to these. He said that the ones for sale recently sold out, and they were 3-bedroom, 2-bath, single-family homes that had a leasehold price of $500,000. And that amount is notable because that's about 1/3 of what the median single-family home price on Kauai is. Kawakami also criticized the way Hawaii has relied on something called inclusionary zoning to build affordable housing. Inclusionary zoning is when governments require developers to build below market rate units in exchange for higher density construction or faster regulatory approvals.
Well, the first thing we did is we very quickly said that we're not going to be able to legislate our way out of a housing crisis. And that's not to say that the legislation that exists or is being worked on are not great tools to have in the toolbox. But I think sometimes we, as government, rely on legislation to be the end-all, cure-all for many of our problems. And, you know, we instead took a different approach. We looked at UHERO reports talking about inclusionary zoning, which is very popular for policymakers to do, but very ineffective as far as actually getting houses built. So really good, you know, on paper, but doesn't equate to housing units being built at the pace that we need to in order to just try to catch up.
So what kind of model does he think Kauai, you know, has that we could apply statewide?
So what he said Kauai did is the county talked to developers and said, so what would make housing construction profitable for you? It wanted to make housing construction profitable so the developers would want to build it, build housing. And the developers told the county that, well, so the high cost of land and the high cost of infrastructure and also the long time it takes to get permit approvals, that all these things drive up the cost of construction. And so what the county did is they said, okay, well, let's try to take care of some of those for you. So they found some public land that developers can build on, and they put in the infrastructure. And then they also did the master planning for the development. And then they said to the developers, here, build here. And so that's what they said they did with Lima Ola. And they said it worked and that this could be a statewide model.
And then what do we know about their campaign coffers? Who's leading at this point?
So Kawakami has a big lead in terms of contributions. So he's raised more than $280,000 for his lieutenant governor campaign. Bilotti has nearly $90,000. But $50,000 of that $90,000 came in the form of a loan that she's made to herself.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, he could outspend her because he's got the deep pockets. Mm-hmm. And I know that he is supported, right, by the super PAC.
Exactly, yes. Kawakami is supported by the biggest super political action committee in the state, For a Better Tomorrow. That's backed by the Pacific Resource Partnership, which is a coalition of contractors and carpenters. And PRP has helped others in the past, like Josh Green. Super PACs can spend unlimited amounts of money so long as they don't coordinate with their candidate.
And, you know, why does this money matter? You know, what should our listeners know about that?
So this, because Luke exited the race so late, the candidates have a really short amount of time to raise their name recognition and introduce themselves to voters. So the money can buy television ads, and that would help them do this really quickly.
And then what about endorsements?
Endorsements. So Bilotti has been endorsed by the Hawaii Government Employees Association. That's the largest union in the state. And Kawakami has endorsements from more unions, including the Hawaii State Teachers Association.
And then, you know, just about when you talk about the lieutenant governor's responsibilities, I know that's varied from lieutenant governor to lieutenant governor. What's the take on that?
So lieutenant governors, they're mostly known for filling in while the governor is away out of state. We spoke to Doug Chin, who was lieutenant governor for 10 months a few years ago. He explained how that works.
That lieutenant governor is basically the backup quarterback. Like they're the person who is acting governor whenever the governor is unavailable or away from the island. And the reason why that is important is for the same reasons why every football team has a backup quarterback. It's because you're going to have some very serious situations, whether in the state perspective, whether it's a hurricane or a tsunami or an earthquake or an act of war or something like that, where if you don't have somebody who's in charge, who's on the island, who's in the jurisdiction, then that could put the state in a very bad place.
And so what should listeners know about this position and why this race is so important?
Well, one notable thing about the lieutenant governor position is that many of the people who served in this office have gone on to more powerful positions afterwards. So a good example is Governor Josh Green. He used to be lieutenant governor. And also Senators Mazie Hirono and Brian Schatz were both lieutenant governors as well. So they, after serving in this job, people can be in a prime position to move on to higher office and lead the state.
All right. Thank you so much, Audrey. Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
We have been speaking with Audrey McElvoy, our government reporter. Look for her stories at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii, located in the outrigger Waikiki, presenting jazz pianist and composer Isaiah Thompson, performing 7 p.m. July 28th. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Senator Carl Rhodes is a longtime chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He'll be honored in October at a gala held by Common Cause Hawaii after 20 years of service at the state legislature. His key legislative wins include passing a red flag law to reduce gun violence, taxing vape products, and restricting campaign donations from corporations. HPR's Mark Liddow recently visited Rhodes at the office that he will vacate in a few months' time. They had a wide-ranging discussion about the senator's career. Rhodes starts with the most important piece of legislation that he says he's passed.
Well, I have to say the biggest bill, and I think I'll feel this way even 20 years from now if I'm still alive, is this last bill that we passed on artificial entities. It's makes it so that corporations, labor unions, limited liability companies cannot spend money on politics. As a function, because all these entities are creations of a state, either our state or somewhere else. And what basically we say, here's the deal. We'll give you tax benefits. We'll give you eternal life. We'll give you limits on the liability as an investor. And in exchange, here's what you'll be able to do. You won't be able to spend money on politics, but you can do pretty much anything else that you need to do to run your business. And that's the deal. It's a huge bill. It has, I've worked on a lot of bills that have statewide implications. This has national implications. I'd be surprised if it doesn't end up at the U.S. Supreme Court or maybe one from another state, but because other states are actively emulating us. In fact, I just talked to someone from Tennessee, a senator from Tennessee, talking about their plans to put in a bill. It was very popular. There was all but one Republican voted for it as well. So I think it does have some traction on the Republican side too, because people are just sick of money in politics. There's always going to be money in politics. There's always been money in politics, but we don't have to have this just flood of dark money all the time from these incredibly wealthy corporate interests, either from inside the state or outside the state. We don't have to allow that. That's definitely the biggest bill. Other ones that stick out, the first bill I passed, the first big bill I passed when I first got here, my first year, which was to keep Kukui Gardens affordable for 65 years. $151 million in financing. You know, I never, this is my first year in the legislature. That was a big win. And I can, you know, when I walk by there, I can see the results. It's still affordable. And that was important to me. I've worked a lot on gun bills because it didn't feel to me like a lot of other people were, especially when I first started on it. So it was my bill that passed a red flag bill that if someone at work or at school that you think they're exhibiting signs that they might be suicidal or might be thinking about hurting other people, you can file with the court to ask the court to take their guns away temporarily. That was an important bill. I did pass a lot of bills. I don't know if I passed the most total in the 20 years I was here, but I'm thinking I was probably in the top five anyway.
The follow-up to that would be, is there any piece of legislation that you wanted to pass but that didn't?
I've introduced a lot of bills. I don't have a very particularly high batting average. Part of the reason I pass a lot of bills is that I just introduce a lot of bills. But now the one that really hurt was the one, not this last session, but the session before. It was a bill that would have gotten rid of, it was an assault weapons bill. But the main thing for me was the size of the magazine. So right now we've had this weird loophole for decades where handguns, you have a 10-round limit on how many rounds can be in a magazine. But for long guns, for rifles, you don't have it. So you can have an assault rifle with a, you know, you can buy a 100-round canister. And they're not very expensive. They're, I forget, $130, something like that. A 100-round canister on a long gun that has an effective range of 300 yards or something, you're just asking for trouble in terms of mass shootings. Anyway, what the bill did was it got rid of all but, you can only have a 10-round magazine, got rid of 50 caliber sniper rifles, which are useless for anything except killing people. There was some other stuff that I didn't view as important, but it all ended up in my bill. It goes to the Senate floor, and we think we have the votes, and then several people change their mind pretty much at the last minute, and it loses 13 to 12. That was hard to take, because there's going to be another mass shooting in Hawaii, and the question is whether it's 10 people or 8 people or something, where you've got the big deal about the mag size is when the person has to reload or change guns, that's when the cops have the best chance of taking them down. If they don't have to reload for 5 minutes because they got 100 bullets to shoot, you know, they can be blasting away for quite some time. That's the problem. So that's what I was worried about. And there will be another mass shooting. I just hope it's, well, if we had passed this bill, I was rationally hopeful that it would only be 7 or 8 people instead of 60. That was a major defeat. I've been licking my wounds on that one for a while.
One thing that I'm going to ask, or that I've asked the candidates for the seat, is what they hope their role will be in the legislature. And I was wondering, just spending so much time here, how you feel like you fit in?
Well, I had set out, I mean, the money committees are far and away the most powerful committees. And I had intended, in fact, I was on finance for the first couple of years I was in office. And I had intended to stay there and, you know, build up some seniority in finance and see what happened. You know, you never know. But the lure of having your own chair is pretty powerful. And when they offered me labor and public employment my second term, I thought about it for a second and decided that it would be good experience to be chair. And also you just have more influence on that particular area. And it was an area I was reasonably interested in. So although I would really hope to avoid having to deal with unemployment insurance because it was such a convoluted system. But then, of course, we had the Great Recession and I sort of had to. So what your role is, I mean, your role is what you can ask for certain things, but you're not necessarily going to get them when you first start out, right? Because you're not the one who's, you're not 100% in charge of making that decision. And then it becomes somewhat reputational. If you do okay and whatever the first assignment you get is, it's like any other job, you'll be considered for something higher up the food chain. It's oddly enough, because if there's a group of more self-aware people in the world than politicians, I don't know who it is. But I've always had a hard time figuring out like what people thought of me internally. And it matters because, you know, what you get in terms of your assignments, or if you decide you're going to try to take the place over and you don't care what people think. I mean, you still have to care. You have to try to put together a coalition to overthrow whoever's in power. which is something I never did. And part of it was because, well, by the time that I had even really seriously considered anything like that, I was already judge chair in the House, which is the second busiest committee. You know, I was chair of judiciary for one or the other for 12 years. So I wouldn't say that that's a bad place to be. I think for in terms of like when you're deciding what to do when you first get in, there's a couple factors. One is you need to do something that's helpful to the district, and some committees are more helpful than others. But you also have to try to work on stuff that you actually care about. It's just easier to work on stuff that you actually care about. You're more engaged, you're more involved, you just care more. And I think a lot of the election stuff, the guns, elections, social issues, issues like same-sex marriage and death with dignity, you know, the stuff that I really cared about. So I think it turned out sort of the way it was supposed to turn out, even though it didn't turn out exactly the way I thought it was going to turn out. But I mean, if you're ambitious, and I never really was ambitious in that way, then you know you got to start thinking about, well, if I want to be president or I want to be speaker, you have to pursue a different course. You have to try to put together a coalition, and there has to be some unhappiness with the current leadership to even really consider it. And then you also have to be willing to be in the wilderness for a while and have no responsibilities and not have committee chairs. In fact, that's one thing that I think is fairly unusual about my 20 years is I never really was in Siberia. I'd been told early on that everybody's in Siberia at some point in your legislative career. And I never really was, unless I get cast into Siberia after people hear this interview. But the way I always looked at it was the factions to me were basically inconsequential. I already felt like I was a member of a faction. I'm a Democrat, right? So the factions are the Democrats and the Republicans. So I was already a Democrat. So why did I have to factionalize even more? So I tended to view the factions as sort of, okay, it's political reality, but you know, really, do we have to spend all our time on this? And as a result, I didn't make that many enemies in the out faction just because to me, they were just Democrats. And I think as a result of that, or at least partially as a result of that, when Sylvia and Scott took over, they were willing to give me JDC, even though I hadn't been in their faction. And when Sylvia offered it to me, I literally laughed at her because I thought she was, well, I knew they had just offered it to Marcus Oshiro. And she was like, well, we had to offer it to him, but we really were saving it for you. And I just laughed. And then that night, I'm like, well, you know, if they're serious, I should probably take this seriously because, you know, if nothing else for the district's sake, I need to be in as responsible a position as I can be.
We've been hearing from State Senator Carl Rhodes reflecting on a decades-long career. We'll have more from this interview right after a break.
Support for HPR comes from the Olson Trust, with a mission to support growing sustainable agriculture, protecting natural resources, and investing in Hawaii's people. OlsonTrust.com.
This July, experience HPR's Live from the Atherton Classical Concert Series. On July 18th, violist Yuri Hughes joins pianist Jasmine Nagano for an intimate recital. Then on July 25th, vocalist Kaylin Howard and pianist Brian Bathia take the stage for an evening of classical song and piano. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org. This event is sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from the State Office of Elections. Registered voters who haven't received their August 8th primary election mail ballot packet can contact their county elections division, elections.hawaii.gov.
Let's get back to our conversation with outgoing State Senator Carl Rhodes. He reflects on being a lawmaker and talks about his post-retirement plans. HPR's Mark Liddell asked Rhodes what he'll miss the most.
The stuff I'm going to miss most is actually really mundane. Like, I think I'm going to miss being able to just come into the building anytime I want and have an office and, like, be part of the process. Just being at the table in a way that, I mean, everybody's at the table. They don't, a lot of people don't realize that they're at the table, but this is being in the legislature. You're at the table. You don't always get what you want, but at least you're in the process. So I'm going to miss having a key to the building. I'm going to miss introducing bills because it was a way to put ideas out there. Even though a lot of my bills were ignored, like I said, I did pass a lot of them too, so I can't really complain. But it was just a formal, official way to put ideas into play. And even Rezos, I'll miss that. I mean, you could introduce Rezos on anything, on Ukraine and the Russian conflict and just anything. And I'll miss that.
Is there anything like your least favorite thing about working?
Least favorite? I don't know. There was a number of things that I did because I knew that that's what you have to do, like raise money. It gets tedious. I mean, I wasn't that bad at it, but some people really like it. And I never really liked it. It was just something you have to do. There were a few things like that. I mean, even like knocking on doors, which I met a lot of really interesting people and nice people. But it was always walking on a razor's edge to me because in three words, you could either the person would like vote for you forever or they would start yelling at you and sick their dogs on you. And you just never knew what it was going to be. It was just tense. It was not always bad tense. It was just tense. But I did an awful lot of it. I mean, that's how a random guy from Indiana wins a race. You knock on doors. Yeah.
On the Citizens United bill, can you maybe talk a little bit about what was it like just having to wait those final moments? I know the end of like session, end of like conference is always kind of wild, but especially with something stakes this big.
So for me, the whole thing was just stressful because Jarrett said he sort of felt like there was a point where it was like a freight train and everybody was just getting out of the way. Anybody who was considering opposing it was just like stepping aside. And I didn't feel it. All I could feel was, we don't have an agreement with the House. It's going right down the wire. We finally get the agreement with the House. We vote with literally like, I don't know, we start voting with like 45 seconds before the deadline. Then we do a floor amendment, which of course puts the whole thing off to the very last day. We still don't know for sure whether Josh is going to sign it. And this is one where I agreed with Senate President was, and Ron was just like, he's going to sign it. He can't not sign that. He's going to sign it. So, but you know, until he does, he hasn't done it. So yeah, it was a glorious victory, but there was so many moments where I thought the bill was dead that it was definitely the biggest bill I ever passed. Yeah.
It was stressful up until you found out that.
Oh, I mean, it's still stressful. I mean, I lean towards the anxious side of the world, but it's not a done deal until all the lawsuits are over. So the lawsuits probably aren't going to be over for 3 years. When I would be really happy is when Supreme Court rules that, yep, Hawaii can do that and corporate money stops being spent. Then I'll feel like I did something.
What do you see yourself doing once your term is like over and you're done? Do you see yourself staying involved in some capacity?
Yeah, I mean, I have no plan. My wife is going to step down from her job and take her ERS retirement at the same time I do. And the only thing we have planned is a 2-month trip across the U.S. into Europe and back. And after that, we really don't have a plan. And I have to say, it feels great. It's like, this is going to be great. Like, we're just going to do whatever we want. Will I get bored eventually? Maybe. If I've gotten bored, then I might get involved in something else. I think it's extremely unlikely I'll ever run for office again. But there's so many boards and commissions and things that you could volunteer your time for if you wanted to. I don't think there's going to be any lack of opportunities. I think actually I'm probably more likely to go off in an entirely different direction. Like I took Russian for 5 years off and on when I was in college and after. But learning a language is a major undertaking for me because I'm not a natural. But to like learn another language would be a really interesting challenge. And it's also useful if you go visit that country. So I think I'm more likely to be slaving away on learning Greek or something when 5 years from now.
It sounds like you're pretty done.
Done. I'm 3.5 months from being done. That's right.
Well, I guess enjoy the office while you have
it. Yeah. So I still got the key.
All right. Well, that was Senator Carl Rhodes, the longtime chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who is retiring this year. His district includes Chinatown, Liliha, and Nu'uanu. A handful of political newcomers are in the running to succeed him. Banks have been in the spotlight with an emphasis on being more food secure. Today, we turn our attention to a spot in Hanumaui. That's where caring hands are nurturing the roots of native coconuts. Coconut palms are used for landscaping and food. And as you drive around, consider the coconut groves and their future, particularly with the threats of things like coconut rhinoceros beetles. Vicky Duran and Indrajit Gunasekara joined us recently to talk about Ko'ali Niu, a nonprofit aimed to protect this cultural resource. Gunasekara provides the expertise. He's the director of the Community Coconut Project under the Department of Land and Natural Resources. And Duran has offered her land to nurture the seed bank. Duran starts us off.
Ko'ali Niu is located on a 5-acre parcel of an ancient system of lo'i in the Ahu Pua'a of Ko'ali in Hana. We have a nonprofit. Our project is focused on the application of coconut agroforestry to create a gene bank for endangered original varieties of Hawaiian coconuts. The Hawaiian Niu, as well as the associated knowledge of the Niu, is at a critical tipping point and will be lost, we believed, if not a culturally scientific intervention was not made immediately. So we hope to solve this issue with our gene bank, and we are the very first gene bank on Maui to find these ancient varieties that are dying out and plant them and share the knowledge, hopefully, we hope to have a cultural program where we share the knowledge with the Hana community as well as beyond.
Well, you know, I grew up on an island knowing that the coconut tree can sustain you and you use every part of the coconut tree. And Indrajit, maybe you could explain to our listeners where you come from and why you know so much about coconuts.
I'm born and grown up in a little village in a town called Matara. My village is called Nadugala in southern Sri Lanka, the southern tip of the island of Sri Lanka. And I grew up in actually a coconut grove that known as goes back to 500 AD, which is a king named Agbo planted this grove to sustain the local varieties of coconut and also to secure the food and the other need for other necessity in the area. And the grove goes back over 12 miles, even more, in the large area. And this is written in one of our historic record called Mahavamsa. And so growing up, I heard a lot of stories of coconut varieties. Why different varieties are being planted for different function. Like example, we have elongated coconut that used for fiber husk, and also sweet varieties that has some high potency and used for medicine and drinking, as well as certain varieties that with the thick shells and things that used for sport and other activities. When I first came to Hawaii in 2004, over 22 years ago. So before I left my home, my mother was alive at the time. One of the things that she asked me to take is one of our very special varieties of coconut, which is called poropol. So it was a custom to us when you go to a new place, you take your best varieties of coconut that been with her family for a long time. So knowing the rule and laws, I knew that I wouldn't be able to bring a coconut with me. So when I came to Hawaii, I started to look for coconut trees, coconut. So first place I saw coconut trees in Waikiki. And it struck me in a way that why these trees look like this? Are they really coconut trees?
Oh, interesting.
And I went in and actually had to touch and see if it's real coconut tree or something made out of plastic and put in its place. So slowly in my time in Hawaii, I was a student at Kapiolani Community College and going through, I think I met you during that time as well.
Yes.
And that question never left me looking, where is the coconut? Where is the actual coconut? Where is the coconut variety? Where is the people who are that has a heritage with the coconut in Hawaii? In that journey took me to meet with Dr. Manuel Ulimaya, Auntie Manu, and to work with her. And to throughout the time, course of time, like about 10 years ago, we are meeting and we are talking about this. And I see that she has been asking, looking to cultivate food system, looking to cultivate the philosophy and understanding. I felt strong, hey, this is something I can do. I can really help. I can really work with. I can enhance my own understanding of the coconut.
You know, and Vicky, just knowing where he comes from and his passion for coconuts, I mean, wow, to be able to connect and tap into that knowledge is terrific.
I know. We've both, Dr. Manu and I, feel very blessed. And she was here a week ago and told me that she'd been looking for jeet for 40 years. And I think coconut runs in Inderjeet's DNA.
We follow certain principles. This is not only growing coconut. So we have a new now. I just got back from Pune, joining a local organization called Pohaku Pelemaka. They have this annual camping around this one of the ancient coconut grove down in the coast of Pune in Opihikai. So I took a group of 16 volunteers to help this event and to practice and to share what we are learning around the coconut. And this is not only the coconut, also bringing people together. We follow an ancient pule that known as a pule niu in Hawaii. Goes back in hundred years that one line speak to the people, kupu ka niu kupu ke kanaka, when the coconut grow, humanity flourish. So we follow principle. This is one of our principle, how to support the community, to lift a community by planting coconut and bringing a practice forward.
That's terrific. And Vicky, you know, how are the coconuts doing? Because, you know, they've been in the ground for a couple of years now.
Yeah, they've been in the ground for about 2.5 years. And the ground actually was covered with hau for about 60 years. So it's very fertile. It's black and it has worms and the coconuts are doing really great. The storm knocked over about 3, but they're going to make it. But yeah, and I want to have everybody check out our website, which is koaliniu.org. It's an educational website. So we are doing a lot of work on letting people know about the different uses and what we went through here. This land was all covered with jungle, with hau and bamboo. And thanks to the Kalunani grant program under the Department of Land and Natural Resources and Maui County grants, we were able to get a lot cleared, but we have more work to do and more what you were planning on. We have 29 coconuts planted that are doing wonderfully and with 8 varieties. And we're hoping to get another 40 trees in the ground with more varieties. I'm just waiting for Inderjeet to return.
It's interesting because, you know, I thought I knew a lot about coconuts, but coming here and seeing the different trees and, you know, the Samoan coconuts, which are smaller and easier to harvest, and then the really tall ones in Waikiki, right? The groves down there along the shoreline. So much to learn about the coconut. But thank you both for making us more aware about where we live and what the Aina has to offer.
Well, it's the tree of life. And we are excited to be able to share the knowledge. Indrajit will be cataloging them, and we'll be sharing the knowledge of the coconut for our community and beyond. And some of it will be on the website.
All right. Well, thank you both for your time this morning.
Thank you so much. Before I leave, I want to let you know that Hawaii has a practice called Uluniu, which is the coconut grow all day. It's a royal practice supported by Ali'i. So today, in the point that most of Uluniu's are being neglected or not being taken care of or being heavily commercialized and undertaken over by cities and places, and that grow system is dying. We see this as a big problem. We need to address and understand what are the trees in this ancient grove, what are the varieties, what are the functions, who are the people, what are the mo'olelos behind that. The work is to bringing them forward and regenerating that ancient grove system again.
Okay, well, we will check back in with you from time to time just to see how you're doing and to check on the progress. It just sounds like a terrific project. And thank you, Vicky, for getting this on my radar.
Yeah, thank you.
We've been hearing from Indrajit Gunasekara and Vicky Durant, who are the driving forces behind a new coconut gene bank in Hanamaui. A fledgling card game about Hawaiian seabirds is getting ready to leave the nest. The project is named Ilele. It means go fly, a play on go fish. A Kickstarter launched this week to fund the first production run. In the game, players build habitats and grow their colonies while avoiding trouble and learning about the seabirds that nest on and visit the islands. Hana residents Scott Crawford and Heidi Lea worked with the Maui Nui Seabird Recovery Project to boost the game's scientific accuracy. The cards also feature seabird names and basic phrases in the Hawaiian language. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Crawford, Lea, and Jay Penniman from the Maui Nui Seabird Recovery Project. Lea starts with the origin story for Ilele.
We were just camping out at Niu'u Bay in Kaupo on the Hawaiian Island Land Trust land. And we were playing another board game that was about birds, but it had so many different parts and pieces, and bringing it camping, it was like, this is too much. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be great if there was a game like Go Fish, but it could be about birds and it could be called like Lele, like fly. And you know, we tried to figure out, well, what would that be in Hawaiian? And there's actually a waterfall out in that south side of Maui, Ilelele. So it was kind of like in the energies of that space. And that night, Scott like woke up the next morning and he was just journaling like mad, just like all the way that the game would come out. And he's like, I need to get the factoids and, you know, all the different relationships between colonies and birds. So it really kind of, it felt like it downloaded through the channel there where we were out under the stars. It's like go fish, but it's go fly. Ilele.
Jay, chime in here because you're with Maui Nui Seabird Recovery Project, and so much of your work is research-based in rehabilitating birds, but there's also an education arm in just letting people know about the amazing wildlife in our own backyards. So where do you see a card game like this coming in to provide a resource for people who may have seen some of these birds out and about, but not even necessarily know that there are native water birds?
Yep, you're absolutely correct, Maddie, that Maui Nui Seabird Recovery Project as a project of the University of Hawaii is not only a research project, but education is totally a part of it. And educating about Namano Oke Kai, the seabirds, and part of that education is combining the recognition that the Hawaiian culture here and the language is extremely important, not only the birds, but the language and the culture. So this activity for us was just an ideal bringing together of our mission and letting people know what Namano Okikai are all about and what are the names of them in Hawaiian. So the card game brings all of those together.
Scott, why do you feel like that was important for you and Heidi as you were crafting the game, like that it would be scientifically grounded, that you would ask, you know, Maui Nui Seabird Recovery for spreadsheets of birds? Like, why was that sense of place important to the two of you?
Well, it felt really important that we try to make the game, well, balancing like playability and fun, that we also try to make it as accurate as possible. And that as you're playing the game, you're learning about the relationships that are based on real ecology, the relationships between the seabirds and the habitats and the threats that they face. And really, when I, you know, reached out to Jay and asked him, can you send me the information on the seabirds, the sort of spreadsheets that he sent, everything just kind of clicked into place and seemed to fit into a structure of a game in a way that worked. And so the idea is that as you're playing, you're learning. And I feel like games can be a really powerful educational tool. But to learn from it, you have to want to play it. And to play it, it has to be fun. That's the first priority. But within that, it really is based on real relationships of seabirds and habitats.
Who do you imagine playing this game? Do you have an image in your head of the same way that, you know, in 2022, you were on this camping trip and wanted to play a fun game about birds? Is that kind of the image that you have mentally when you picture who's going to play Elele?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's families, it's parties, it's classrooms, and anybody who has an interest in conservation. So many people love birds, you know, whether, you know, birders or just people who are into nature, and gamers like yourself, people who, you know, who like to have family time or party time playing games, and also language learners, people who are interested in kind of interacting with the language, with, you know, learning Alelo Hawaii in a very interactive way. So it's very Hawaii specific in a certain way, but I also think it has a pretty broad audience of people who can have fun with it.
You demoed a prototype at the 2023 Hawaii Conservation Conference. What changed based on the feedback of playtesting, not only with people who liked card games, might even enjoy a game like Wingspan, but conservation professionals who know their science?
Yeah, one thing that we found, one table of playtesters there really didn't want to play the threats and hurt the birds. And so out of that, we developed a alternate set of rules for playing a cooperative version of the game. So if you really don't want to play cats or mongoose or light pollution on the other players' colonies, then there's a way that you can play cooperatively and all work on building the colonies together.
Oh, I love that there are people that didn't want to hurt the birds. A question I have for you, Jay, as we celebrate these birds and raise awareness, is that so many of them really are under threat. And so how do we balance that curiosity and the joy with the harsh realities that a lot of these species are facing?
It's very true that there are a lot of threats and the birds populations have been decimated. But I think that the example that Maui Nui Seabird Recovery Project is one of is that if you work together and educate the community and Ke Ao Hali'i, the organization that Scott and Heidi work with in Hana, is very much a part of raising awareness that you can protect the birds. If it means putting up predator exclusion fences, if it means doing predator trapping, talking with our neighbors and our government people about creating light or zones at night that are dark and minimizing the amount of nighttime light, using it just when you need it out, turning off your lights. If you don't need them, putting them on motion detectors, using low blue content lights. All of these things result in benefiting the birds. And we've seen colonies where we can protect the birds on both Maui and Molokai expand from almost no reproduction going on to there's two colonies, one on Maui, one on Molokai, that in 2020 or 2000, there were no breeding birds. And in this year, there are more than 5,000 pairs at each of those colonies. And that's just from public awareness and predator control in those areas. So it is possible. And the more we raise awareness through games like Elele, the more people realize and can help contribute to saving these birds.
Scott and Heidi, do you feel like you have seen nature or seabirds in a new light since working on this game?
I definitely have. I pay attention to seabirds a lot more, and I'm just looking out for them. And because of that, I notice them a lot more. You know, they're around. Just the other day, Saturday, I was out on the shoreline in a booby came flying overhead, and I was able to identify it, you know, and would not have known what it was if I hadn't been, you know, working on the game and educating myself. So I'm hoping that others who play it have that same kind of experience of becoming more familiar with the birds. And also, because it's a memory game, the way Go Fish works is you have to remember what other players ask for, and then you know that they have that card. So the more you know the names of the birds and are familiar with them, the better you are at the game and the more advantage you have. So it motivates people to learn the names of the birds and get familiar with their habitats.
So you're testing your memory at the same time. Heidi, anything you'd add?
Just that there's been a lot of advancement. I think it's happening more rapidly, I guess, because we have trucks that are coming out to East Maui that are doing seabird monitoring with really interesting equipment. And there are these success stories, like Jay mentioned. For me, it's just this kind of inner comfort of knowing that I'm more part of a community that's doing anything to support just the knowledge and putting that care into action. So I guess that having a game that actually builds something by playing it has been really fun. And also, like, we've invited ourselves to play games with our neighbors. And it's been fun to see how it's such a easy thing for people to jump in on. We just went to play with this couple who lives across the street, and like four of their friends popped in, and we all just took them and played pairs, and it was awesome. You know, so it's really just been a joy to see people push into that place where they have to ask for things using our native language here, and then, you know, being triumphant at the end, regardless who actually wins or not. It's like everybody got to participate along the way. So I think it's good.
We've been hearing from Heidi Lea and Scott Crawford, creators of the card game Elele. We also heard from Jay Penniman from the Maui Nui Seabird Recovery Project, who helped in developing the game. And since launching a fundraising page for the game this week, Lea and Crawford are nearly halfway to their goal. They plan to go into production this September and distribute the first sets later this year. That's it. We're all pow for the day. Tomorrow we have a Summer Reads Hanaho show lined up for you. Let us know what you're reading. Got a good book you want to recommend? Leave a voicemail on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.